Today's topic is the top 10 planning considerations for real estate investors. For years, real estate has been in the doldrums following the Great Recession and the fallout during that period of time, where values of properties had not increased, rent values had not increased. There were pockets of places, Northern California, where some of you are on this call, certainly in the Brooklyn communities as well, and other places around the country where values have gone up as well as rents. But in other areas, we found that the real estate markets, if in anything, remain flat to stagnant. So that has begun to change. The new tax laws under the Trump bill have provided some advantages for our clients, and every high-quality portfolio, one way or the other, includes insurance as part of it, whether it's the investment of REITs or it is a second or third home or it is a home you're purchasing for the purpose of your children or grandchildren, whether they're in college or recently married. But beyond just the primary residence, we're seeing more and more people focusing on investing. That in itself needs to also be couched in terms of individuals and families who have invested in commercial real estate in a more ambitious way, some overseas, but certainly in the U.S., whether it is owning storefronts that you're converting more to medical uses, owning office buildings, certainly multifamily homes, apartment buildings, any type of industrial space. Many of our clients and you all have components of this, either owning individually inside of a partnership with several others or certainly through investment vehicles like REITs. As an investor, there are some elementary principles, and we're going to talk about that today, but some of the items are more sophisticated. Please take note that the purpose of these calls always are to stir you and to have you grab your pen and paper and say, that's one I didn't know about, and then take the time to shoot us an email at john@mcmanuslegal.com for answers that we can coordinate with you and certainly dive more deeply. That is what our relationship with you is all about, for we to be thought leaders, to be making marriages between your ideas and the proper legal approach. So first topic is, how can landlords solve for concerns regarding liability and mitigate risk pertaining to their investment properties? As a real estate investor myself, I must highlight to you that we are strong in our feelings that every property should have its own separate LLC. Now, there are some clients whose accountants and others have said to them, you could have two properties inside of an LLC. That isn't necessarily a mistake. It may provide a little bit more efficiency for you, but understand that if there is a lawsuit because of something that arises at a particular property, which is inside the LLC, all the assets inside the LLC are subject to liability and forced dissolution in order to liquidation in order to pay off the liability. So we try to limit the each individual LLC to own one piece of property. I remember years ago driving down the FDR Drive, my dad was taking me, and I said to him, why does every cab have a different name on it? And he said, because each one is a separate owner, and so for liability purposes, only that cab and the owner of that asset would be at risk. So we continue to encourage you to do that. Now, each LLC requires a simple filing, but there is a pass-through opportunity here. So The simple LLC filing is a multi-hundred dollar annual return, and you would be picking up the income expenses on your personal return. We would tell you also that if there is one owner on the LLC, then you don't have a requirement to file a return on the LLC on an annual basis, and you just pick it up on your normal return. Some clients have said, I'm going to create two LLCs, 50% ownership for myself and 50% for my spouse, and then each spouse, then since the LLC is only a single owner, you can have two owners on the that own the property, and each individual can file their returns without having to do an LLC return itself. I personally do not take that approach. I don't think that it's a bad approach. My wife and I keep our LLCs with us in one name, and we file our returns. And this is a big part of our practice here, helping our clients get those returns filed, and we can do that for you. Part two is to make sure that you have proper liability coverage. Today, we never know how high a lawsuit can be brought, but if multiple people were maimed on a property that you own, to consider that liability could be $5 or even $10 million is not outside the realm of reason, particularly in the big cities like San Francisco or Miami or New York City, where the juries are prone to give and award larger amounts. The coverage for an umbrella that would be up to $10 million at minimum, we believe, is job one. Look at that and say it's a small price to pay. We have high-quality carriers that exist out there. If you need help with that, we are happy to make recommendations, and for sure can allow you to do assessments over multiple carriers to know that your coverage is good. I would also emphasize to you what we do is every year we review our coverage and then have our broker rebid out our coverage to decide whether or not we should continue with our current carrier or move to someone else, number two. So for sure, you want to keep that in mind. And then the last piece under number one is for cost efficiencies, please keep in mind that you can raise your deductible as high a number that you can afford and know that it will help your annual premium. So please address that. Now, if you are passing through your expenses for your insurance to your tenants in what we call triple net leases, then I would urge you to not have the highest deductibles, because your tenants are properly, as agreed upon by the markets and by your contract, paying the insurance coverage. And the last thing you want is to find yourself in a position where you're picking up the deductible as the owner and the tenants are not bearing their proper responsibility as agreed on the contract. So if your tenants are reimbursing, then you want to not have the highest deductible, even if your premiums are higher. If you're paying out of your pocket and no expectation of your tenants, then consider having a much higher deductible to reduce the premium that's coming directly out of your pocket. Number two, cost segregation. Cost segregation is a comparatively new strategy for tax planning, and its purpose is less to minimize taxes but to defer taxes that are paid. In some instances, in the end, the result is that the tax may never be paid, which is good news legally, that it's proper. But in the late 80s, the laws changed with respect to depreciation. And depreciation is the notion, which you all know as real estate investors, that each year you get to take the value of all of your improvements on top of the land, not the land itself, but the improvements, and you get to take a small piece of that decreasing value or the need to do improvements over time, repairs, maintenance, and so forth, upkeep, and you get to take a fixed amount based on the entire value of the property, the improvements. In the late 80s, the tax laws changed because it was far too beneficial to the investors, said the legislatures, and they said, we're not going to let you take the amount that you are against your income, these deductions, and they eliminated what we called accelerated depreciation, except for a few narrow areas, and some of that was student housing and low-income housing where you could get greater tax benefits to encourage new construction in those two areas. What's happened since then is it had a significant impact on the real estate market because people said, well, if I can't get those tax deductions through depreciation or big enough ones, then I'm not going to pay the same price for real estate. And so it had a decade-long drag on the real estate investment industry. Then we come to recoveries in the market and so forth, but this plan by Congress to allow for a more efficient way to take deductions through expensing in the immediate year has come into fold, so that when you buy new properties today, you can find yourself being able to take deductions in the immediate year that are far more significant than you have in prior years. The second piece, though, is for those of you who already own real estate, historically you would work on what we call a 30-year schedule of depreciating the entire improvements versus just any one piece of machinery or equipment. Along comes this process of segregating the various systems that you have in your building, and you need to have an engineer, an engineering group, and an accounting group, and we do this in-house here, where we then segregate things like your air conditioning units, the improvements you've done to a particular space in your building when a tenant has left and you've had to gut the space and put a new tenant in, doing work in improving your parking lot, or your roof, or replacing windows, et cetera, that may be broken. These pieces now are on a much shorter schedule as opposed to the 30-year schedule. So, for example, if certain equipment is a 5-year schedule, we can depreciate that equipment. Maybe there's $100,000 to $300,000 worth of air conditioning units that you're replacing, and you get the deduction within 5 years. And so that tax benefit comes to you far more quickly rather than getting only 1/30th over the next 30 years. The essential aspect to know here is that unless you undertake cost segregation, you're going to continue, for those properties that are in your name, working with getting very little tax deductions offset against your income, which is the way that it's been for the past 25 years. The new law says if you purchase new properties, you can get the deductions up front. However, what if you own existing properties? And the only way to get around that is to focus on segregating all of the systems within your buildings and then being able to accelerate the depreciation on a much shorter schedule. And when there's new equipment that comes in, to take that expense immediately in the year that it's purchased. So talk to us, send us an email if you want to learn more about the details of cost segregation under the new tax rules. Number three is real estate professionals. So if you're strictly in the business of real estate investing, then you're able to offset the income that you have against your losses. But if your losses are greater than the income, you can offset that against any other income that you have in other businesses. However, if this is not your primary business, then you find yourself in a position that if your losses are greater than your expenses, and if you're doing proper tax planning, and for us, real estate is an awesome opportunity to do among the most sophisticated tax planning and get benefits up front. If you have losses greater than your income, then you have to carry over those losses in tax benefits to future years. But you want the tax benefit now in 2019. But since this is not your primary business, you cannot offset the losses against your other income. So if there is a spouse or a family member that is the spouse is the only one that this works with, that is a real estate professional, then your income from other areas can be offset against the real estate losses that you have. The point that I want to highlight here is being a real estate professional is a tremendous advantage when your losses exceed your income in certain years. Of course, they're paper losses, but if you've had a major renovation or an improvement that you've made, or it's a year to do significant repairs to the roof, that would ordinarily offset your income. And in this instance, if your income is not sufficient enough, we can offset it against any other income. So being a real estate professional, however, requires that you identify that you're working almost 800 hours a year in the real estate business. You need to show things like looking at new properties, working on existing properties, negotiating with tenants, and keep a log of this. It is the inquiries sometimes can be 2 and 3 years out, but if you have your log, the IRS will acknowledge that, and you will continue to be viewed as real estate professionals. Reach us on that one as well. Number four, what are the benefits of a 1031 exchange, and what steps must be followed to implement? So the key piece here for many of you is that when it's time to sell and that you feel the need to sell, in order to avoid paying the gain, there are some strategies, paying the gain immediately, there are some strategies, and one is to roll over the gain, which we were able to do in residential properties for many, many years, but today you can no longer do that. You cannot do this in commercial properties either. However, if you purchase a substitute property, you can roll the gain over into the new property, and there are a series of issues. There has to be an independent corporation created where the funds from your sale of your property go into that corporation, and then they go on to purchase another property. You have to identify and purchase that property within a short period of months. So before you sell, you want to have those new properties in line and close on at least one of them. But the gains can be significant. The gains and the savings on taxes by avoiding that gain are even greater. So doing the 1031 can avoid, for some clients, writing a check for several million dollars in gains tax and avoiding that by doing the 1031 exchange. You have to be careful. You have to identify properties ahead of time. You have to be prepared to move quickly. It is not unusual for someone who has not done great homework in this area to find themselves in a position where they're now forced to move quickly to buy another property, and you can smell a 1031 exchange purchaser a mile away because they will pay up for your property just to get to avoid the gains tax that they're otherwise going to suffer, because now they can roll over the gain into your property. And so avoid being that person that everybody can identify that's in a, has a sense of urgency and will need to buy your property. Number five, what is a monetized installment sale, and why could it be preferable to a 1031 exchange? The participation of a third-party intermediary can defer the capital gains to be paid in increments over a 30-year period and allow for the step-up in basis when the sale proceeds are deployed for the next real estate transaction. So by having a installment sale as opposed to an actual full-on sale where you close, the proceeds are paid paid to you over a period of time, and you're only acknowledging the gain for the piece that you're getting paid at the current amount. So if it were a $100,000 property and it was over 10 years and each year you've got $10,000, you're only acknowledging the $10,000 gain in that 1 year while the rest is coming to you over a period of time. Of course, $10,000 a year is not a likelihood, but imagine if we're talking about a $10 million property that you own or a $100 million property you own and we're getting the payment over a period of years. The purchaser has to cooperate in this instance as well, and it's important to have them know that this is what your plan is. They may want to fully deploy the resources up front, and our view is that the math has to work from a tax standpoint. As we get more and more involved with our clients, they're always trying to squeeze alpha out of their returns on their investments by coming up with sophisticated tax plans. The three that we've addressed up to now so far are each ideas here where you can avoid the tax drag, which impacts your yield and enables you to get a greater return, at least near term. So in that instance, the payments can be over a period of years, and if you pass away along the way, the basis gets stepped up at the time that you pass away, and then the remainder of the purchase can happen right then and there because then there's no gains tax with your basis being stepped up for the purchase portion. Okay, number six, what do we know about opportunity zones? So under the new tax law, there is the creation of multiple places per state where you can invest in properties, and if held over a period of years, the sale of that investment would not suffer a gain. There are increments to focus on that if you hold it for a certain period of years versus all the years, that there would be some deferral of gains as opposed to a total obviation of the gains tax altogether. If you want to learn more about opportunity zone investing, please reach us. Several of you who are on this call are currently in opportunity zone investments, and yet know you have the flexibility that you can get out of this before the entire period. And sometimes you have to make that tax decision. You may say there's a lease coming up that we can't be sure is going to renew, and it's going to be a substantial part, contribute to the value of the property. So our goal here is to get out now, even if it's costing us some tax, rather than risk waiting to the end of the opportunity zone period and maybe the value of the property going down significantly. So what if we didn't have the tax? So with opportunity zones, the most important aspect is they're usually in developing areas. We certainly have them in the New York area. There's some in Buffalo that are doing great things. They're frankly all over the country. But you need to, opportunity zone investments are ones that you cannot just let the tax tail wag this investment dog. You need to look at this property in total and say, regardless of the gain, we need to be in an investment that will give us a gain in the years going forward, so that we're not in a position where we were worried more about the tax savings and we have no gain to show. Please reach us if you want to learn more about the Opportunity Zone funds as well, which are ways that you can invest more broadly. Number seven, what are the advantages of the family limited partnership as a real estate holding company? So family limited partnerships are, of course, multi-purpose entities that can consolidate the management of real estate investments. They can also enhance liability protection, and they facilitate wealth transfers. So you may have 1, 2, 30, 50 different properties, some big, some small, et cetera, where each one of them is held in an LLC, but you're overseeing them all. So So there's a value to wrapping them all in one big ownership entity. A master limited partnership is one word, or a family limited partnership is another. And as the general partner of the family limited partnership, each owns all of these units of investments. A two-family in Harrison, a multifamily in Miami, a student housing in Northern California, a turnaround shopping center in the suburbs of Chicago. Each of these in themselves are operating individually, but having the family partnership wrapper provides another layer of protection in the event that you are sued, because they can't even get to that one individual property without potentially forcing a liquidation of the entire partnership. And if the partnership is drafted properly and within the states that allow for this, you can find yourself where the creditor cannot even get to the single asset that we have in the entity, number one. Number two is that there is good centralized management, where there may be a management company. We've created a management company, and its purpose is to oversee the proper management of each of the properties, and it in itself is its own cash flowing entity, and allows for a neat opportunity to do estate planning, because you can transfer that management company into trust, number one. Number two is you can slice off limited units of this master partnership, limited partnership units, non-voting units that we can discount because of their illiquidity, and bring those as well directly into trust for your family. Once it's inside of a trust, now we have a third layer of protection. So a trust as the first form of attack, a family limited partnership wrapping all the assets behind that, and then the LLC. Each of these in themselves makes the work of someone who is trying to take your asset away from you extremely difficult. The insurance that you're buying that would be for each of the properties is designed primarily to make the payouts to justly deserving plaintiffs without you finding yourself at a risk that your property is being taken away. But again, the master partnership is one of the most efficient ways to do estate planning, to take those non-controlling units and put them into trust for your children and your grandchildren, where you and your spouse still have access to them, but for tax purposes, they're off your balance sheet. Number eight, what is a step up in basis, and how does it impact the decision to gift real estate? So as you know, through depreciation, which we've spoken about earlier, we can reduce the basis. The impact of getting tax savings on an annual basis also means down the road, your basis for purposes of establishing your gain is subject, is reduced, and you will have a higher gain at the time that you sell, unless you insulate yourself through either a 1031 exchange or moving forward with a monetized installment sale. The best way to lift basis, but the most permanent way, is if you pass away. And so if you keep those assets in your name, when you pass away, basis gets reset. The issue, of course, is, well, if they're in your name, are we now subject to estate tax? So each of you has to have an analysis with us to determine what you should be giving away and what you can actually keep in your name, and whether or not you're going to have a big estate tax. One clever way to have your cake and eat it too is to borrow against your properties, where you still own the property, but then you gift the proceeds of the loan to your children so they receive the cash for which their trust can invest, and you continue to keep the property in your name, and when you pass away, that property is valued significantly lower because there's debt mortgage against it, and the property gets its basis reset. So please consider the values of keeping assets in your name as part of the step up in basis strategy. Number nine, what is the alternative to gifting low basis property? So, again, the key piece here is using depreciated property as leverage to secure the financing, and then moving the asset, allowing the investor to preserve the step-up basis, as we've just stated. But it also allows us to provide valuable advantages for loved ones who could continue to hold the investment years afterwards and reset the depreciation schedule. So if your property's improvements now on your passing are going from are worth $10 million, the improvements themselves, and basis is reset, you now restart your whole depreciation schedule and you can have this additional tax benefit. It is essential to consider the stepping up of basis when you pass away, which will enable your family members to reset their tax benefits through depreciation. Also consider, and you can reach us on this, upstream gifting, giving properties worth $1, $3, $5, $10 million in trust to your loved ones, and then that are much older, and when they pass away, the asset can drift back to you and your family in a trust. It's more than this conversation will allow for, but will enable a resetting of the basis. Upstream gifting, send us an email, and we can speak in detail about that. Last is life insurance as an essential planning consideration for real estate investors. We often hear that real estate investors talk about their total assets but are always clamoring for cash flow because there's a new project that needs to be done or there's a tenant that's left and now we have to pay broker's fees and build-out fees and lawyer's fees. And so we find ourselves that there's always a cash flow struggle. However, if you have $10, $20, $50, $100 million worth of real estate, whether there's a cash flow issue or not, when you pass away, there will be an estate tax. And you may be able to move a chunk of those assets through the partnership strategies we discussed earlier into trust before you pass away to avoid the tax. But invariably, there is an estate tax, and life insurance is one wonderful strategy to enable a liquidity event to take place to offset the estate tax that you'll have on these properties that you haven't been able to give away. Life insurance comes with its own issues because you have significant premiums for the larger policies. Yes, it's excluded from your estate. Yes, the premiums are building up cash value inside the policy and they're kicking off dividends that could be in excess of 5%, and all of that is tax-free inside the policy. All reasons why we are enamored with life insurance as a strategy, but you may not have cash flow to pay the premiums. So there are strategies often just focusing on financing those premiums with your assets that you have in real estate and then using that financing to pay the annual premiums. After several years, the cash flow inside the policy is significantly large enough that you can release any other security interest that you have for the loan, and the insurance carrier and the lender will say, we'll just accept the cash value in the life policy as the security interest. And the dividends from those policies will get to the point where they are sufficient enough to then pay the loan down over that was used to originally purchase and fund the life policy. So life insurance itself, awesome idea for insurance, for real estate to offset life insurance, the estate tax, but also insurance can be funded through premium financing. It is a sophisticated strategy. It comes with certain risks. Rates can climb. And in the open markets for your loan, unless you get a fixed rate, personal liability can occur unless you get non-recourse financing. And performance on the policy is always something that is at risk, even though the highest quality carriers, and you've heard me review those names in the past, have historically provided a dividend remarkably consistent year over year. And see, even some of the old granddaddy companies have never missed a dividend, much less cut below, much below a 5% rate of return. So we see this as a appropriate investment for real estate as well, balancing the financing risks that you could have.